So augmented reality is going to help us mix the digital and the physical in all new ways, and that's going to make our physical reality better. So that's why this is such an important trend.
That's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg spreading the Facebook's Brave New World gospel regarding the merging of consciousness and computing. Actually, if you listen to a bunch of the things that he said out there on various interviews and whatnot, he's actually taking his foot off the pedal a little bit with this group of developers. In other videos, he straight up talks about mind reading, telepathy, and even mind control as all being part of Facebook's glorious future. And you know what? He might be right. Now, of course, you know, Skeptico's always been about controversial science and spirituality related to consciousness, and that doesn't always mix perfectly with technology. But if we're going to be honest, we have to accept that technology has a fantastic role to play in cutting through some of the philosophical bullshit that sometimes dominates the spiritual and even the consciousness discussions. I mean, when there's a mind reading app you can download for your iPhone 20, some of the spiritual questions surrounding consciousness will no longer seem relevant. And if I can make a bit of a leap here, the same goes for UFOs. The main question that seems to have dominated the UFO field for the last 10 years is whether we should remain focused on nuts and bolts technology, sightings, landings, that kind of stuff, or whether we should shift the focus to experiences and experiencers. And as you know, in that realm, science is thrown out the window. It's all about the idiosyncratic phenomenology of what you experienced. And of course, Dr. Jacques Vallée has been a leading thinker in this area, and his ideas about linking extended consciousness realms to the UFO phenomenon are kind of well documented and well deserved. And I, of course, covered this topic recently in my interview with Vallée, and also an interview I had previously with Robbie Graham. But since I hadn't heard from anyone in the nuts and bolts camp, I decided to turn to my old buddy Stanton Friedman, because here's a guy who's been around for so long, and I think he's been unfairly characterized and unfairly cast aside, if you will, in this discussion about UFOs and consciousness. So Stan and I talk about a number of things. One of those is this technology angle as it relates to consciousness, which is really a great point that I haven't really talked about before, and I'm really glad that Stan brought it up. Here's a clip that I think gets at that. When I go through all those, I continue to get the characterization of Stan Friedman as he's a guy who's just interested in nuts and bolts, and the UFO field has moved on, and it's interested in experiences and experiencers. One, how do you feel about both how you're being characterized there and how the field is being characterized, and whether the field has and should move from worrying about nuts and bolts, sightings, and that kind of stuff to being interested in experiences and experiencers?
Look, I'm co-author of the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And I'm certainly convinced not only that the event took place as described in the book, but that there's a lot going on there that isn't really conventional. I'm convinced that there is another aspect to the phenomena that's very important. Call it not just telepathy, but being able to control other people, being able to exert control over parts of the physical world that we don't really know how to deal with. Like I say, when I hear about people, I've listened to tapes of people reliving the experience of watching aliens go through the walls. And it's scary.
Stick around. All that and much more from Stan Friedman today on Skeptico. Today we welcome famous UFO researcher, author, and nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman back to Skeptico. Stan is one of the absolute giants in the field of UFO research. I'm sure many of you know that already, but just in case you didn't, I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of TV appearances, radio appearances, thousands of lectures around the world, and of course, several books and many important articles. He has just such a vast, broad knowledge of a lot of different aspects of UFO research, even some of the ones that we're most interested here on Skeptico in terms of the overlay with consciousness science and some frontier science. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Stan, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Great to be on again. I love doing radio. I don't need to wear a tie.
And before we even get started, I wanted to mention, because we had an email exchange, and I'll talk more about that later, but in the email exchange, you reminded me of the nuclear physicist part, which is an important part of your background. You lived that world for quite a while. And
14 years.
And you reminded me, by looking at your bio, that, you know, you were right there with the military-industrial complex giants, McDonnell Douglas, TRW, Westinghouse. You know, we could say you were
General
deep
Electric.
yeah. You were deep state before we called it deep state, or at least you were part of that whole that whole machine. What did you have a sense of that back then, that, you know, it was
Well,
like,
I was excited. My first job out of school, I'm working for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. And great guys to work with. The work was classified, but I was involved in a number of experiments. I got a chance to meet a lot of good people, publish papers, do stuff like that. I thought I'd spend my life with them. It didn't turn out that way because, as with many other programs, mine got canceled. It's kind of crazy how things go up and down in the military, the R&D world. GEAMP, Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion. In 1958, we employed 3,400 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. And we spent that year $100 million, when that was a lot of money. So we're not talking about a few professors and a couple of grad students sitting around a big table. I did experiments in several different places. It was exciting for a kid fresh out of school, you know, University of Chicago. Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years. He chose the right time to go for a PhD in astronomy because Sputnik went up in 57. And that certainly excited the world and the politicians, because the Russians were beating the heck out of the United States at that time in space, you know. So some of those programs were huge. Some were exciting. Almost all were canceled.
Right. You know, I had a little bit of an experience with that when I got out of school. While I was still in school, I was studying for a PhD in artificial intelligence, and that was of interest to Texas Instruments at the time.
Sure.
I always remember being there and having two-thirds virtually of this huge complex being walled off behind a glass wall that, you know, only people with these special badges, but getting little glimpses and chats with them. You know, I always remember this one gold badger, you know, that was as your badge progressed, you'd got these different colors and the gold was the highest. I remember talking to this guy at lunch and asking him, you know, what he did. I was completely naive kid, you know, in college. And he said, "I've always been around death and destruction my whole life. And I guess that's how it always will be." And then he kind of disappeared again behind that glass wall. So I think what you bring to that, just in talking about it, and I think in general, your research and what you've brought to this field, is a certain grounding of, hey guys, there's a reality to that. This stuff happens. Some of it is pretty deep and dark like you hear of it, but some of it, and like what I just heard you say, some of it's very ordinary stuff. It's about making proposals, about getting budgets, about, you know, then spending those budgets, fulfilling those commitments or not, you know. I mean, do you ever think about...
There was some fun.
and fun. But do you ever think about that in terms of this world that you're in, the UFO world, in terms of maybe a gap in terms of what people understand about how these worlds can simultaneously exist?
Yes.
That is the world of the deep state, you know, the scary deep state, and the world of, hey, just some really smart engineers trying to solve a problem.
Well, yeah, I'm concerned about that. And I'm concerned that people, I get people telling me these days, oh, you can't keep secrets about anything, Stan, with the internet and so forth. And that's malarkey. You can keep secrets. It's, look, the Lockheed program to develop stealth aircraft, they spent $10 billion in 10 years in secret. The first spy satellite for the United States was the Corona spy satellite in the late 50s, early 60s. There were 12 failures before they had a successful one, all in secret. The 13th one got more data about Soviet military installations than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. They kept going at that, and for another 30 years, there were Corona spy satellites, all in secret. Nobody knew about them. You know, that's the way it is. And people should remember that keeping secrets is primarily a national security kind of concern. Why should we let our enemies know what we're capable of when they're not letting us know what they're capable of? In other words, every country on the planet would love to be able to duplicate a flying saucer, wouldn't they? The flight capability, you know, up, down, back, forth, right angle turns, et cetera, et cetera. Silent
ultimate
flight.
Weapon. It's the ultimate weapon.
Yeah, everybody would like to be able to build one. So we've recovered several. I'm sure the Russians have too. But why should we put out what we have learned if they don't put out what they have learned? You know, this is a world this year, terrible term, but this year we nice guy earthlings will spend $1 trillion on things military. That gives you some kind of clue that that's considered important. We live in a dangerous world. And so we need to take that into account. Secrets can be kept. I get people telling me, oh, all those guys, when I talk about MJ-12, Operation Majestic 12, 12 guys on there, well, they would have told their wives what they were doing. No, they wouldn't. I never told my wife anything classified. It would be utterly stupid. I could lose my job, for one thing. I can't control what she says, talking to friends and idle bits of this and that that somebody else might pick up on. You just don't do that. And it's naive on the part of some people. The academics seem to be particularly concerned with, well, research is what goes on at universities. You know, you publish papers in peer-reviewed journals. There's an awful lot of stuff that doesn't get put into peer-reviewed journals. I'll guarantee you that. And the thing is that the big area I'm concerned with here is technology. You know, how do you fly this way or that way? How do you spy this way or that way? All kinds of things. And I've had the privilege of working under security for 14 years and working on a number of canceled government-sponsored programs and of recognizing that there's some point to the classification. And we act sometimes as if that whole world didn't exist out there. You know, look in the journals, Stan. That'll tell you what you want. No, it won't. As a matter of fact, I had the experience when I was working on aircraft nuclear propulsion. I was working on radiation shielding. Because if you got a nuclear-powered airplane, you really don't want to cook the pilots. Not a good idea. And so I had the need to know, and I looked at an abstract journal, classified journal, that listed new documents out each month. And, oh, the Navy was doing some nice shielding work. Great. So I went to our document control people. I'd like to get copies of these things. They come back to me not too long later. Stan, you don't have a need to know. yes, you've got the right clearance, but you don't have a need to know, and they're not giving out any needs to know, a need to know on those programs. So you learn about these things, and that's the real world. And, you know, it sounds crazy to some people. A scientist is supposed to be open and, you know, talking to his peers, and like I say, peer-reviewed journals. And it just doesn't work that way. And, you know, anybody who thinks it does is being terribly naive. And so I'm sure we have recovered crash flying saucers, at least at Roswell and in the plains of San Augustine and a few other places, Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, Aztec, New Mexico. But I'm sure, almost certain, that the Russians and others have recovered them other places. There are crazy things that happen to flying vehicles inadvertently. Not many people crash them intentionally, but, you know, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time for something to happen. What can I say? So I'm aware of that, that's all.
That's interesting that you say that, because it seems to me that you're aware of that on a couple of different levels. You know, we did have this email exchange, and I appreciate some of the things you said. You said, hey, maybe we could talk about this, like all the Goldilocks planets that are being discovered. And I said, hey, that sounds to me like kind of a controlled release of information. To which you correctly replied that you weren't involved in the controlled release of secret information, and that you followed the rules in handling of classified information. I totally get that. I totally respect that. But there's a whole host of questions associated with that, as you just kind of talked about. And let's go through some of those, because
okay,
first of all, you kept your promise, you didn't break the rules. But are we really to believe in this day and age that that is necessarily something that everyone should follow all the time? How do you feel about the government potentially releasing people from their NDAs, from their non-disclosure agreements, when those disclosure agreements were entered into under false pretenses or with as part of a larger misinformation campaign? Should people really have to keep their secrets when they were bound to those secrets under kind of false pretenses, if you will?
Well, I don't think there were false pretenses.
Well, sometimes they were. Maybe not in your case, but sometimes they were. And you were involved with one of the largest, most public disinformation campaigns, probably in UFO history, with the Richard Doty, Bill Moore thing. So, I mean, you got firsthand, up close and personal with how these things can really be, really go wrong, didn't you? Is that how you
see
it?
Well, I don't think of it that way. I think Doty was doing his job, and sometimes you have to put out this information. Okay, I don't like that, but I understand it. As I said, the first country to duplicate flying saucer behavior is going to rule the roost. And it won't be cheap, incidentally, to do that. That's one of the things people don't understand, is how much it costs to develop entirely new technology. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. That costs bucks, lots of them. And so you can't do it easily. If it were easy, it would have been done before, you know. It's the basic notion.
I'm surprised to hear you say that Doty was doing his job. On one level, I get that. On another level, it seems to me that he was stepping outside the bounds that we normally associate with constitutional government, with oversight, with how the government is supposed to treat its citizens. I mean, him and Bill Moore, you know, drove Benowitz crazy by sneaking into his house and rearranging his furniture in a direct attempt to kind of drive the guy insane, and they did it. I mean, that's not doing your job.
I'm not saying he didn't go overboard. I'm not saying, on the other hand, that I don't know if there were any orders from powers that be that things are getting touchy here, guys. We've got to do something to stop the movement in the direction of people finding out what we're doing. Misrepresentation, part of the picture, sure. The greater good for the most people, all that sort of stuff. I don't like that notion. You know, it would be nice to live in a free and open world where everybody tells everybody everything. But that's not the world we live in.
Right.
And, you know, we're talking, look, the development of the Manhattan Project cost many billions of dollars. We built a facility to separate uranium isotopes. I mean, to put uranium, normal natural uranium in at this end and get highly enriched uranium-235 at the other end. That facility was a mile long. It used 5% of all the power being generated in the United States,
right,
even though this was in the midst of a war. You know, so we had to build guns and planes and tanks and ships and all that kind of stuff. 5% of the power in the United States went into separating uranium isotopes, and nobody knew about it, except the people who were directly involved. So, you know, it's a price you pay. But, you know, people don't realize how close we came to losing World War II.
Right.
Thank goodness we broke the German codes, for example.
Right.
You think we were going to broadcast, hey, look what we did. The fact that we had broken the codes, Enigma and all that stuff, wasn't revealed for 25 years because other countries were using those codes, too. So we were listening to their conversations, if you will. So there's a lot going on, and it's distressing that we live on a planet like that. And I tell people we're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. I'm not proud when I say that. There must be a better way to run a planet. Hopefully some of the aliens know that. It would be nice to think that we're Johnny-come-latelys. We don't have our act together yet. But sometime I have a great-grandson. I wonder what kind of world he's going to grow up in. You know, it scares me. To give you an example, the crucial form of energy production in the universe is nuclear fusion. That's what goes on in all the stars, every single one of them. Some big, some small, some powerful, some not so powerful, if you will. And people say, okay, you're talking about weapons. I say, no. Anybody who's got any brains knows that if you're setting off nuclear weapons, you also know how to travel to the stars. What? Well, that's true. I worked on a study of fusion propulsion for deep space travel in 1962, which makes me feel ancient to tell you the truth. And the conclusion was, if you want to go, all it takes is dough, lots of dough, lots and lots of dough. But, I mean, that's what the planet this year, military budget, $1 trillion.
Okay. $1 trillion, that's on the outside, right? I mean, we know by government accounting that there's, at this point, something like $20 trillion that is lost, right? So,
well, we don't know, we think. And there are people who make claims, a lot of claims going on without being established as true.
I don't know. Catherine Austin Fitz has the math done pretty well at about $16 trillion. I mean, we remember a few years ago, the day before 9/11, when it was announced that we lost $3 trillion, that the State Department can't account for $3 trillion. I trust the numbers that it's up to $16 trillion. I'm not saying, I'm with you to a large extent, Stan. I think your point is very sobering and realistic, that this stuff goes on. We can't look the other way, but I'm just saying, the off the books amount is probably a factor of 10 of that $1 trillion.
Well, I'll say maybe. It's in my gray basket. Not
sure.
Black, not white. Maybe. Because when you don't know, you don't know. And guessing is fine. If you're playing the horses, I guess. Sometimes you even win. I know people. I just read a story in the paper. Somebody won the lottery. Special lottery, only $500,000 in cash. I haven't won the lottery. But the unlikely and unusual does happen from time to time, and it's sort of unpredictable. But I think the thing about UFOs and aliens is we have to change our attitude about a couple of things. It wasn't too many years ago that we thought, gee, this is the only solar system, and Earth's the only one that's got water on the surface and oxygen in the air. Boy, we're special, guys. And now, I hate to say this, but we're not special at all. The Kepler space satellite, which I'm a great fan of, incredibly sensitive to pick up planets going in front of a star. You know, it's like seeing a butterfly go in front of a traffic light 2 miles away, you know, and reduce the light from it. We now think that there are between 1 and 1.6 planets per star. So what does that mean? Well, within 100 light years of here, just down the street, there are 10,000 stars. That means between 10,000 and 16,000 planets within a mere 100 light years of here.
When you say planets, you mean planets that are most likely...
No, I mean planets, period. All kinds. Big ones, small ones, fat ones, small ones, thin ones.
One planet. You're saying 1.6 planets per star?
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot more than that.
That's what they're saying.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I looked this up because I was curious as heck. What's the latest scoop? And remember, Kepler only looks at a certain chunk of the sky. You don't dare have it look at the sun because it blasts all your electronics, your optics out of it. But even that, I'm not saying all those planets between 10,000 and 16,000 within 100 light years. I'm not saying they all have life. Maybe it's only 10%. That's still a heck of a lot when you stop to think about it. And also, the time factor. I mean, dear old Bishop Usher back in the 1600s, he was hept on sex, if you will. He was looking through the Bible at all the begats, and he worked it out so that the world must have been created in 4004 B.C. I don't know whether he said it was a Thursday afternoon or not, but 4004 B.C. Now we know that the Earth is at least 4 billion and 4 years old. 4 billion. There's a big difference between 4 billion and 4,000. obviously. So what I'm saying is there's plenty of time for there to have been planets come and go and civilizations come and go. And, you know, maybe we're in a no man's land where it's forbidden. There's a sign up, stay away from Earth, a bunch of idiots there.
Right.
And the kicker is we have to recognize that there's somebody out there. And if you look at, say, the case of the Minuteman facility in Malmstrom Air Force Base, saucer shows up, there's a bunch of rockets underground, ICBMs loaded with nuclear weapons, and this UFO shows up at the gate, and the guy calls down to the guy in charge underground, and he thought he was joking, frankly, and, well, don't worry about it. He calls him back in a few minutes, obviously greatly distressed. And, you know, this thing is really here. And within the next couple minutes, 10 ICBMs went offline, one after the other. Now, theoretically, that can happen. Designed to be independent, of course.
Right.
But it did happen. So, and similar things happened in the Soviet Union. One of their events we've heard about is that the missiles went online, which is even scarier.
Right.
In this world in which we live, there are prospects for terrible things happening. And, you know, I hear people, the SETI community, I call them Silly Effort to Investigate, you know, SETI, not Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, because they're ignoring all the UFO data. You look at their books, they don't even reference the good books on UFOs. I reference their books, even if they're not good, but, it, you know, there is a lot of data out there, and they refuse to see it. Obviously, if you don't, if you're here, if they're out there and coming here, it could be of concern to us. How could we ignore that? We don't know if they're good guys or bad guys.
All this gets back to a topic we were talking about just a few minutes ago, and that has to do with disclosure. In a way, it traces back to that, because, and I think you have an interesting perspective on this that I haven't heard expressed a lot of times, and I'd like to talk to you about it, because you live through several of these waves of disclosure. You know, you mentioned the Majestic 12, MJ-12 documents. That was, we all thought that was going to be one of the biggest cases or the most clear-cut cases of disclosure. It's all out there. Now we know, blow the lid off it, change the world kind of a disclosure. And whether you say it was a misinformation plot and a disinformation plot, whether it was, I think, as you said a few minutes ago, someone deciding, hey, we need to refocus this, redirect this, it certainly turned out that way. And I wonder what perspective that gives you on this new round of disclosure that we seem to be heading into, where it's coming, guys. It's right around the corner. Here it comes. Get ready for it. You're going to learn all the secrets kind of thing. I mean, haven't you seen this story before?
Well, I look, one of the things that's intriguing about MJ-12 is how many phony documents were put out after the stuff hit the fan.
Awesome. Sure. Completely.
And so that leaves many people able to say, well, see, these documents are phony, so ignore them. I'm saying there are three that are genuine. They're the ones that matter. I don't care about the phony ones. It's standard practice to put out this information.
Standard practice by who, for what reason, and why would that? I mean, so forget MJ-12. Set it aside for a minute, all the confusion. How about that part? Standard practice for who, for what reason, and what does that say about how we should feel about the current round of disclosure?
Well, I see no reason to say that there really is a current round of disclosure, except a bunch of guys claiming that it's going to happen. I think that we need to recognize that there are good reasons for keeping secrets, and you don't want your enemies to know what you know, A, about what you know, or about what you know they know. Because the weapon, counter-weapon, counter-counter-weapon, these have been games we've been playing for a long time. So I think that it would be standard practice. If something slips out, do whatever you can to cover it up. You can't just stand up and say that. You put out crap, if you will. MJ-12, that's why I use that, because as I have a book out, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C, which goes into a number of the documents and why I say they're phony. And it's clear they're phony if you look carefully. And it's kind of funny how the debunkers glom onto disclosure in their own way. Philip Klass challenged me on one of the MJ-12 documents, the Cutler Twining memo, to be precise. Well, obviously, it's a phony document because it's done in the large PICA type, and the National Security Council used only small elite type, and I've got 9 documents to prove it. And he offered me $100 each I'll give you for every genuine document meeting a whole bunch of rules, if you will. You have 60 days, but he set a limit only on 10, unfortunately, or I'd be a wealthy man. Anyway, I found out, I mean, I went to my files, and I spent a lot of time at the Eisenhower Library, the Truman Library, Kennedy Library, etc. And I immediately found 20 documents that were done in the large PICA type. It's easy to see, actually, when you look at them alongside other ones. So I knew that was a bunch of baloney, but I was going to the Eisenhower Library, so anyway, and soon, and so I went, found 14 that met every single condition he put on them, and sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000, because he set a limit of 10, and he paid me, and he got madder than heck when I published a copy of his check.
Right.
And I finally told him, I said, look, Phil, you sent me a check. I Xeroxed the check. I took the check to the bank. The bank cashed it. I can do whatever I damn please with the Xerox. And so he shut up. But it turns out, and I didn't know it until then, I thought I ought to check. And it turns out he'd never been to the Eisenhower Library. I've spent weeks there. But that's typical of the intellectual bankruptcy of the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. And the question is, who's he working for? And he claims he didn't work for any three-letter agency. Well, how about a four-letter one?
Like what? You know, what four-letter one?
I can't even think of one. Psychological Strategy Board? No, that's three. I had a list one time. I made up several of them. But the point is that Phil made claims without anything to back them up and thought he would get away with it. Well, he didn't. But it is typical.
See, but there's so many layers to this. I don't want to get... I mean, that's an important point regarding debunkers, regarding skeptics, regarding... I don't want to slam somebody I don't know personally, but the useful idiot versus the lifetime player. So there's some people that are in this mix that are there to specifically serve a purpose. So Doty is there, and Doty comes out and says... Hey, I do this stuff. They pay me to go and do some very dastardly kind of stuff that is anti what our Constitution says we're supposed to do. But wink, nod, we all know goes on, and all we all accept as part of the way we keep the Huns from marching over the hill kind of thing. So that's given. But then there's a whole other group of people, and this is more to my experience with Skeptico, and in particular with science and materialistic scientists who, you know, just want to hold to their paradigm. There's a lot of useful idiots out there. Of course, the phrase that everyone borrows from Joe Stalin, who talked about the American communists who were just up in arms and doing his bidding without him doing anything. I said, hey, man, that's great. They're working on my behalf without me even having to do something. So that's part of the landscape, and I get that, and I'm glad you fill in that history. But a more interesting part to me that I keep coming back to is, as you alluded to, you know, who's deciding that among the handful of legitimate MJ-12 documents that are in existence, we should package those with hundreds of other documents to create this elaborate smokescreen. And then I'll let you answer that. And then I want to bring that to the current round, because I do think that is happening again. And I'd love to hear your perspective on it. But first, maybe that question.
Well, and my latest book, it's a year old now, is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. And we focus on three people. Phil Klass is one of them. Debunkers, disinformation specialists, whatever you want to call them. And one of them was Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, a Harvard University professor of astronomy, and as a matter of fact, for a number of years, the chairman of the department. And that's pretty high up on the pecking order when it comes to, important scientific people. And I discovered, because I took the trouble to get permission from three different people to look at his papers at Harvard, and his name was on a list of people, and I didn't know what to make of it. So I got permission from three different people, he was dead, to look at his papers, and discovered to my total shock that he wrote Jack Kennedy. They knew each other. They even had breakfast together on occasion in a Boston area. Kennedy was from the Boston area. After Jack was elected president, Menzel told him, there's one area where I may be able to be of assistance to you. I've got a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency, NSA. No such agency, you know, never says anything. That's
right.
What NSA means. And when we are properly cleared to each other, this he tells the president, mind you, I can tell you more. And so I did a lot of follow-up on that. And the failure of the media, for example, there was a huge hearing, and they were trying to take away Menzel's clearance. I saw a comment from his lawyer to Dr. Vannevar Bush, one of the important scientists in the country. And it was kind of weird that why are they trying to take away Menzel's clearance? Why does he have a clearance in the first place? And, so, and one of the surprising things was, and I don't know how they managed it, there was nothing in the New York Times or Washington Post about that. This goes back to like 1950, you know, there was a communist under every bed and two under the twin beds. It's crazy. So it turns out Menzel was a world-class cryptologist. That's what the NSA is all about, of course. But and there's even a paper in a scientific journal, The Cryptologic Contributions of Donald Menzel. And he did classified work for all kinds of people. Nobody knew that. I'll guarantee you that. People were telling me, Stan, it couldn't be. He was a debunker. Well, I'm sorry. Here's what the evidence shows, you know. So who was he? We know he was working for the NSA. Mm-hmm. About 30 years worth of, you know. And
Vannevar Bush, fill that detail in. Vannevar Bush, who's long been connected with the early on UFO secrecy, and we have all these memos that say he was like one of the main guys. So is there anything to him standing in the way of this guy's clearance? Supposedly, or we can deduce from what you're saying that clearance would somehow be used to share some information with the President of the United States. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, I think Bush knew what was going on, no question. If there was one scientist who was at the top of the heap, he was involved during the war in developing all kinds of new technology, new stuff, classified stuff. And that's what he was about. And I was, as I say, shocked to find out. I wasn't surprised that Bush was involved. I was very shocked to find out that Menzel was involved.
Right.
And I developed a healthy respect for Menzel because he was working for his country's well-being, if you will, in what he was doing, contributing his knowledge and capabilities to keeping us a free and open society. And like I say, a lot of people don't realize there were some tough moments during World War II, and we weren't so sure we'd be winning. Thank goodness for secrecy. For example, one of the concerns was if the Japanese found out about we were going to drop an atomic bomb on them, they'd move American prisoners of war into that city, wouldn't they? Go ahead, you know. So there were games being played, but they're deadly games. And I developed, as I say, a healthy respect for Menzel after realizing that he was working his butt off for the government.
Then let's fast forward a little bit and take that perspective. Sure. Bring that perspective with you. And let's talk about some of the figures that are on the scene now, because this is really going to be fascinating. Because, again, you've lived through this history. You were right in the middle of it. I mean, you weren't like reporting on it. You were in it. What do you make of Stephen Greer? What do you make of Stephen Greer? He's got a new movie, Unacknowledged. What did you think of the movie? And were you surprised to see Richard Doty show up? Again, a confirmed disinformation agent. He shows up in the film. There's no explanation that he has that background. There's no consideration of it. He's just, hey, here's an insider in the government. So all three of those, what do you make of Greer? What do you make of the movie? What do you make of a disinformation agent?
I saw the movie at a conference, and I was not favorably impressed. And my feeling has always been, I've heard Steve speak many times, that he really doesn't understand security. And I'm bothered by things like he was offering people the opportunity they could spend the weekend at his farm in Virginia. It cost $600 and some, they're all expenses covered. But they would have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. He would tell him everything he knew. This is from the guy who's in charge of the disclosure movement. I mean, that's pretty damn silly. And I think Steve, look, he's a charismatic speaker. He gets around a lot, gives a lot of talks, makes a lot of money, I guess. But I don't consider him. He doesn't do the kind of research we're talking about. He doesn't go to the archives to check on documents, to dig out the goodies, if you will, painstaking though it may be and frustrating though it may be, but when you find something, wow, you know.
He did disclose, he did have some documents he disclosed from his meeting with the CIA director that I thought were significant, no matter how you spin that. I thought that was...
Well, remember, they had lunch together. He made it sound like he was briefing him. You know,
I don't know if those guys, I mean, his claim, and I think he has some merit. Again, I don't know what to make of him. I just want to hear your opinion of it. But, you know, to sit down with somebody for 2 hours and take a presentation for 2 hours and say, gee, that was lunch, when he's talking about, you know, here's everything I know.
Well, I didn't hear that it was 2 hours. I heard that it was much shorter than that. But I don't know. And I don't have any good way to find out. I mean, you could ask Steve, but why would you believe him if you think he may be inclined to exaggerate, misrepresent, overstate? Those are words I would use with regard to him. People who've never had a clearance don't seem to understand that there are different ways of thinking once you get a clearance. I'll tell you, I developed a healthy respect for security when I worked at GE. If you left the document, this is a closed facility, mind you, guards at the door. You needed a clearance, that fancy badge that you were talking about. And the guards would go through the facility at night. If they found a classified document out, you'd get a call at 10 o'clock at night. Mr. Jones, we found a classified document on your desk. Please come in and inventory all your documents. That's not a fun procedure. And if it happens twice, you're in real trouble. And three times, you're probably out. So you develop a very healthy respect. One time, I always remember this, I was going to give a classified talk at a conference on radiation shielding. And for some reason, my slides didn't get finished. I prepared all the material, but they weren't finished by the time the regular courier was supposed to go. So, Stan, okay, you have a need to know for this material. Obviously, you developed it, so we can make you a courier. And they sat me down, and all the rules, you know, the slides don't go in the trunk of the car in your briefcase. They go with you in the car with your briefcase. And a whole bunch of other things. I'll tell you, I was never so glad to get rid of stuff when I got to the other end. I mean, really aggravating, because they're scaring you. You know, and the whole tone was, we don't give a damn about you. We care about your classified material. And so you have to recognize that, okay, they don't care about me. I got to be careful what I'm doing, because they're going to come after me with all hell will break loose if they discover I've done something that doesn't follow the rules. So it upped my understanding of the terror that's used to keep people in line, if I could put it that way.
Right.
You know, so you mentioned somebody else, Steve. And
well, the other person I thought we should kind of bring to the fore and see what you think is Tom DeLonge, getting a ton of press lately, and very strange, in my opinion, in terms of how that's being rolled out. Of course, he's the former frontman for Blink-182, has expressed an interest in UFOs for the last 10 years, has had all these associations, was closely associated with John Podesta, who has some very deep, troubling connections to some other kind of nasty stuff. But now here we are in late 2017, and DeLonge has this big, big announcement that's coming out, supposedly, and it's technology-centered, which always kind of throws me for a loop. But jump in there. What do you think about Tom DeLonge?
Well, I read most of his book. He's got a big, fat book out there. And I won't say he's not sincere. And I won't say he hasn't met with a bunch of these people who are in the need-to-know world. But how much we can... I have no independent means of checking about whether he's feeding us garbage that somebody fed him,
right,
to confuse the world, you know, so that the New York Times can dismiss it, if you will. kind of thing. I don't know. That was a surprise, hearing about Tom and seeing how thick his book is and how many people are jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak. Not the first guy you'd think of as being concerned with UFOs. And again, he didn't have a security clearance, as far as I know. No indication that he did. And I wonder if he really understands how security works. But in other words, is this disinformation off to the side to create confusion so that people stay away from the good stuff?
Right.
That's a sensible procedure. You know, why not? Disinform.
You know, one thing I wanted to throw out there and get your opinion on, because, again, I come at this whole thing from a totally different perspective. My main interest is consciousness science, so we study near-death experience, psi phenomena. Last time I had you on, I thought you did a marvelous job of connecting us to the Betty and Barney Hill case and how that leads right into some of this extended consciousness stuff that, again, no one ever gives you credit for. They always say, oh, Stan's the nuts and bolts saucer guy, and that's all he knows, and that hasn't been my experience. But let's leave that aside for a minute, and I'll tell you, when I hear somebody talk about UFOs and they lead with and lean too heavily on the technology component, I'm always a little bit leery. I mean, we're talking about information that would completely change our understanding of who we are, where we came from, why we're here. And then you're going to lead with, oh, and it's going to be free energy for your car. I mean, it may be free energy, but the social implications are so much bigger. I do always feel like I'm being distracted. And I don't know how you feel.
I agree with you. I agree with you. There are a lot of distractions out there. And I keep telling people when I have a chance that I'm convinced that the aliens know a heck of a lot more about the crazy stuff, if you will, near-death experiences, mental telepathy, you know, stuff like that, that the rest of the scientific community doesn't want to deal with in general. Now, there are a few guys who've got guts, but not many. And I'm convinced that there is a lot we don't know, and part of it is because it's our unwillingness to admit that we don't know. We're smart guys, you know. We know what's going on, don't we? And frequently the answer is no. So I don't think we've spent enough time looking at the non-conventional aspect of UFO technology, if you will, if you consider. I mean, look, how does a guy go through a wall? You know, go through a window without breaking the glass? I don't know how to do those things. And that's weird. It's important. It tells us that there's a lot going on that we don't know about. But I'm, in a sense, considering the primitive society we have on this planet, I mean, let's not forget, we killed 50 million people during World War II. We destroyed 1,700 cities. Could anybody say we're nice guys? Mm. I mean, who would want us out there? And so I'm convinced that there is evil use could be made of a lot of this, not just the technology, faster vehicles, right-angle turns, and all that sort of stuff, but of these other things, mental control of others. You know, that scares me. Who's going to rule the roost here if we give them half a chance?
Stan, in general, how do you feel about this characterization that I hear over and over again? And I said to you in the email that, you know, just recently I had the chance to interview Robbie Graham about his new book, UFOs Reframing the Debate, a book that, again, says, hey, we should be looking at this consciousness model of UFOs. I interviewed Jacques Vallée. Maybe we're definitely going to talk more about that if I can squeeze a few minutes. When I go through all those, I continue to get the characterization of Stan Friedman as he's a guy who's just interested in nuts and bolts, and the UFO field has moved on, and it's interested in experiences and experiencers. One, how do you feel about both how you're being characterized there and how the field is being characterized, and whether the field has and should move from worrying about nuts and bolts, sightings, and that kind of stuff, to being interested in experiences and experiencers.
Look, I'm co-author of the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And I'm certainly convinced not only that the event took place as described in the book, but that there's a lot going on there that isn't really conventional. And so, yeah, I guess people call me the nuts and bolts guy. Some people might just say plain nuts, but I'm convinced that there is another aspect to the phenomena that's very important. Call it not just telepathy, but being able to control other people, being able to exert control over parts of the physical world that we don't really know how to deal with. Like I say, when I hear about people, I've listened to tapes of people reliving the experience of watching aliens go through the walls, and it's scary. That's incredible. So I'm interested in that stuff, but I don't know what to do about that stuff. I'm a nuclear physicist. Okay, right. I know what to do about that. But all this mental stuff I find fascinating. But again, it's I'm in physics, not psychology.
Stan, what do you think? What do you think of Jacques Vallée? I enjoyed the opportunity to interview him just recently. He's kind of made the rounds again. I think he has some really interesting things to say. Then I love to juxtapose those with some of your thoughts and comments. But first, what do you think of him in general? You've had.
I like him. I've been at his place in San Francisco. I see him at conferences from time to time, and we seem to get along very well. I won't characterize how he thinks of me because I don't know, but we seem to have hit it off pretty well. I think he's a very bright guy. And, you know, he suffers from association with astronomers. What can I say? Well, astronomers, you know, don't know anything about deep space travel. They don't know anything about security in general and stuff like that. So they're cut off from an important part of the UFO world. But I think Jacques has done a great deal. He's written several interesting books, and he's quite good at getting people interested in what's going on. But coming at it from an entirely different side of the world than I am, in most senses, you know, yeah, I'm nuts and bolts, okay. No, I think he's one of our leading lights. I mean, he's getting old, so am I, you know. And he's been around a long time. And I give him credit for sticking to it.
I give you credit for sticking to it. And I think you don't get enough credit. I mean, look at this. We've been going at it for an hour. You are on as top of your game as you were the last time I talked to you 5 years ago. And I can go listen to an interview with you 15 years ago. You're moving forward. You're on top of the issues. I think that's fantastic. I think you're a fantastic resource for this community and a giant in this community whose shoulders we all stand on. So let me just throw that in there unsolicited.
Well, it sounds very good. My ego is happily pleased by such things.
It's the truth. It's the truth. But let me tie that to Vallée, because I found, and to my surprise, and I think a lot of people were looking for something else, I found a lot of similarities in where Jacques Vallée is today with some of the things that you're expressing. One, Vallée understands the idea of secrecy, understands the idea that, you know, maybe as troublesome as misinformation and deception is, that it's part of the package, and conspiracy comes with the territory. And, you know, he also was a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. You yes. can't be a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley and not be knee deep in conspiracy every day. That's your lifeblood. You know, you
do yes, not I'll agree with that.
Tell
I'll
people stuff, that. But also just in terms of, you know, you ask Vallée, and again, you know, people ask him about MUFON, you know, and again, he's misunderstood as somebody who says, oh, we should move past sightings and all the rest of this. He says the opposite. He says, oh, no, that's important work. We should continue all that work. So I see him as somebody who has one foot firmly planted in the nuts and bolts, if you will, because that's the data that we can at least kind of get our arms around a little bit, and another foot in this big question mark area, the mental phenomenon part that you're kind of talking about. And I see him having the similar kind of balanced approach, only with an emphasis on maybe some areas that he's more comfortable with in terms of exploring on the mental and psychological side, because he's chosen to focus on that.
Well, I think I agree with you, and I think he's one of the leaders of the field. He doesn't make a lot of noise anymore these days, but he shows up at conferences, and I respect his opinions. I don't say that about everybody, to tell you the truth. So Jacques is a good person, as far as I'm concerned.
What do you make, in a more broad sense, about where the UFO field seems to be heading? And I know that's a really general term, but I mentioned a minute ago that there has been this move towards consciousness, attaching consciousness to UFOs, and you hear that as kind of a meme. What do you make of that in general, or what do you make of the direction that the UFO community seems to be heading in other ways?
Well, I think we sometimes give the community, to make it in capital letters, the community.
Right.
But it's a whole bunch of little people who have different views and different purposes, different reasons for doing what they're doing. I think one of the things that's changed, as I indicated earlier, is that we're now aware that there are probably planets all over the place out there. And that changes things. We're not special. You know, we're not the only ones. And I think, I hate to keep reminding people that if you're into nuclear fusion, you're into deep space travel as well as destruction. And people are shocked when I say we have exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons on this planet. People look at me, what do you mean, Stan? Yeah, that's right. Look it up. 2,000 nuclear weapons. That would tell anybody in the neighborhood that we're capable, if we choose to do so, to go out and bother them. And that's a serious notion. Got to watch out for those damn Earthlings, you know. They're bad guys. They have no qualms about building weapons of mass destruction. And without seeming to be concerned about helping the people live a better life, you know, improving the status of the planet and all that sort of stuff. So I think there are some aspects here that we need to do more looking at. And I think some people who want to move away from nuts and bolts are forgetting that they're an important part of our society. You know, when I show people slides of an aircraft carrier, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, and point out that you realize that this big old monster is 1,000 feet long, 1,100 feet long, can operate for 18 years without refueling. People look at me, what? I said, yeah, 18 years. That makes a difference. If somebody's got that kind of capability, and there are more than one country has built nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. So there is technology there that cannot be sneezed at. If you're a ship captain, somebody says, oh, you don't need to worry about refueling until 18 years from now. He says, what? You know, I thought I'd have to worry after a few months, maybe, out on the ocean. So I think there are things here that need to be taken into consideration. Attitudes about killing people, about being decent to people, about learning about our local neighborhood. We have not made a real effort to do that, as far as I'm concerned. And I wish we would. And that's not just the nuts and bolts. I'm talking about the mental stuff, which I think is very exciting. But I don't pretend to be an expert at that. I'm a dumb old physicist. You know, what can I say?
Well, I think you can say quite a bit. You have said it, and I certainly appreciate it. Stan, tell folks what you're up to nowadays, where they can find out more about what you have done and what you continue to do.
Well, the easiest way is to go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. That's FRIEDMAN.com. And that lists my books. It says forthcoming. I'll be giving a talk in Little Rock, Arkansas in 3 weeks. I'll be at MUFON, of course. I'll be talking in Eureka Springs, Arkansas in April. After that, I don't know. It's the first year I haven't had a lot of bookings into the future. And I'm not trying to get them. I'm getting old. It's getting more difficult, you know. And I haven't yet talked about writing another book. Kathleen Martin and I have done 3 books, which I enjoyed working with her. Different viewpoint, but very bright, very sharp. So, you know, maybe it's time to write another book, maybe a personal book. I don't know. But I'm enjoying being old in the sense that I am still able to get around. I'm still able to think. I haven't given in to Mr. Alzheimer yet. I won't guarantee that. So if they look at my website, all the books I send out, I autograph personally. I'm a one-man operation. I don't have assistants who do all this stuff for me. Maybe that's what keeps me younger. Doing my thing. I'll be celebrating my 84th birthday in July. Me and Benito Mussolini and Peter Jennings. How's that for a trio? July 29th, 3 cheers for us.
that is quite an auspicious grouping there. It's been absolutely great having you on. Please allow me, if I need to call on you in the future if you need to refresh something and bring us all up to date on what's going on in this fascinating, fascinating world of UFOs. So thanks again.
My pleasure. I look forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks again to Stan Friedman for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I tee up from this interview is, should we be looking at the consciousness link to UFOs from more of a technology perspective? Is this yet another thing that the aliens have figured out how to do and that we can't quite do yet, but once we get there, it's all just a matter of engineering, more or less. So NDEs, working in the astral realm of psychedelics, telepathy, certainly, all that stuff. Maybe it's just technology. It's an interesting angle to consider. So let me know your thoughts on that. Any way you want to reach me is fine. I encourage you, of course, to always do the Skeptico Forum where you'll have the best chance of getting an answer, but any way you want to reach me is fine. And of course, as always, do check out the Skeptico website. Approaching 400 of these kind of interviews, if you like this one at all, or if you like consciousness, science, skepticism, that kind of stuff, and kind of calling out the pseudo-skepticism that is so much a part of science, well, then you'll probably like Skeptico, so do check it out. I have some great shows coming up. Do stick around for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.